From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We commenced the lawsuit this morning on behalf of several people who actually went to the Ecuadorian embassy to visit Julian Assange. And unbeknownst to them, we've learned through several sources that, in fact, all of their equipment when they went into the embassy were taken, imaged, and in addition, their conversations were recorded by a company at the direction of Mike Pompeo of the CIA.
The CIA and former CIA director Mike Pompeo have been sued for spying on U.S. lawyers and journalists who met WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange while he was living in political asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. We'll speak to the lead lawyer who filed the suit. But first, defund the FBI. That's the growing call by Republicans after the FBI raided Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate.
I think every single candidate and elected official in the GOP right now needs to go on record pledging to defund these lawless agencies.
We'll speak to Brooklyn College professor Alex Vitale. His latest piece is headlined, "There are good reasons to defund the FBI. They have nothing to do with Trump." Plus, we look at the growing calls for longtime prisoner Matulu Shakur to be granted compassionate release. The 72-year-old Black liberation activist has been jailed for over 35 years. He's now suffering from bone cancer and is reportedly near death. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Georgia, prosecutors have informed Rudy Giuliani he's the target of a criminal investigation into interference in the 2020 election. Giuliani is scheduled to appear before a special grand jury in Atlanta tomorrow, where he faces questions about his efforts to keep former President Donald Trump in power. Giuliani led Trump's attempts to overturn the results of Joe Biden's victory in Georgia by more than 12,000 votes. Giuliani repeatedly cited baseless conspiracy theories and led an unlawful effort to put forward an alternate slate of presidential electors. Meanwhile, a federal judge in Georgia has denied a bid by Republican Senator Lindsey Graham to quash a subpoena ordering Graham to testify to the grand jury in Atlanta. Fulton County prosecutors want Senator Graham to explain the reason for two calls he placed just after the 2020 election to Brad Raffensperger, Georgia's Republican Secretary of State. Raffensperger told reporters after the calls Graham had hinted he should throw away ballots from areas where Biden likely got more votes.
He asked if the ballots could be matched back to the voters, and then I got the sense it implied that then you could throw those out. And he really would look at the counties with the highest frequent error of signatures. Well, it was just an implication that look hard and see how many ballots you could throw out.
South Carolina Republican Senator Graham has promised to appeal the order compelling him to testify in court, arguing he's shielded under the Constitution's speech or debate clause. The Justice Department's asked a federal judge not to unseal a sworn affidavit used by the FBI to recover 11 sets of secret government documents from Trump's home in Florida. The affidavit was the basis of an application that convinced a judge to sign off on the warrant used by federal agents in their search of Trump's Mar-a-Lago residence on August 8th. In a federal court filing, prosecutors said the affidavit contains highly classified material and sensitive information about witnesses, and that its release would compromise the continuing investigation. Voters in Alaska and Wyoming head to the polls today for primary elections. In Wyoming, pro-Trump primary challenger Harriet Hageman is poised to unseat incumbent Congressmember Liz Cheney amidst backlash over Cheney's role as one of two Republicans on the House January 6th committee. In Alaska, former governor and 2008 Republican vice presidential nominee Sarah Palin leads a crowded field seeking to fill Alaska's lone U.S. House seat, which had been held by Don Young for nearly half a century before his death in March. Meanwhile, Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski faces 18 Republican primary challengers, including pro-Trump candidate Kelly Schiavacca. Last year, Murkowski was one of just seven Republican senators who voted to convict then-President Trump after the House impeached him over the January 6th Capitol insurrection. The Biden administration's ruled out releasing roughly $7 billion in foreign assets held by Afghanistan's central bank on U.S. soil. That's according to The Wall Street Journal, which reports Biden's decision not to return the funds came after he ordered the assassination of Al-Qaeda's leader in Kabul. This comes as the United States warns a staggering 95% of Afghans are not getting enough food, with that number rising to almost 100% in female-headed households. Earlier this year, Democracy Now! Spoke with Masuda Sultan, Afghan-American women's rights activist.
Human Rights Watch agrees with us. The head of the UN agrees with us. The head of the International Rescue Committee, David Miliband, agrees with us. You talk to just about every humanitarian organization, any economist, they will tell you that a central bank's reserves belong in the central bank. But instead, we have just decided that Afghanistan cannot have its central bank reserves, that that economy will now be crippled. We just knocked the legs out of it, and the humanitarian crisis will just grow and grow. Afghanistan will be an aid-dependent country.
Masuda Sultan is founding member of Unfreezing Afghanistan. Ukraine's military says an elite unit operating behind enemy lines was responsible for a massive explosion at a Russian ammunition depot earlier today in the Russian-annexed province of Crimea in southern Ukraine. Video shows a huge fireball and smoke rising over a village in northern Crimea near the site of the blast. Russian state media described the explosion as sabotage that damaged civilian infrastructure. This follows another explosion last week at a Russian air base in Crimea, which destroyed as many as 9 Russian warplanes. Elsewhere, a massive United Nations-chartered ship carrying more than 23,000 metric tons of wheat has left a port in southern Ukraine bound for Ethiopia. It's the first shipment of food from a Black Sea port in Ukraine since Russia invaded more than 6 months ago. In Kenya, William Ruto has been declared winner of a highly contested presidential election. Kenya's Electoral Commission says Ruto defeated the former prime minister and opposition leader Raila Odinga by a narrow margin, getting just over 50% of the vote. Ruto has been deputy president of Kenya since 2013. His party, the Kenya First Coalition, has also won a majority of seats in Kenya's Senate. At least 4 Kenyan election commissioners said they did not support the results due to the opaque nature of the vote count, as diplomats and international election officials were removed from the tallying hall right before Ruto's victory was announced Monday. Ruto will serve as Kenya's 5th president since its independence from Britain in 1963. He addressed the East African nation Monday.
There is no room for vengeance. There is no room for looking back. We are looking into the future.
In Saudi Arabia, women's rights defender Salma al-Shahab has been sentenced to 34 years in prison over her advocacy. It's reportedly the longest sentence ever given to a Saudi women's rights activist. Al-Shahab was initially sentenced to a 6-year prison term over tweets she posted critical of Saudi Arabia's treatment of women. But an appeals court last week increased the sentence to 34 years behind bars and banned al-Shahab from leaving the kingdom for an additional 34 years. Human rights advocates warn of worsening conditions for Saudi women as Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman intensifies his crackdown on dissent. Saudi Arabia's state-controlled oil company has broken its own record after posting a profit of $48.4 billion for the second quarter of 2022. It's the largest quarterly profit ever posted by a publicly traded company, coming as Russia's invasion of Ukraine helped push oil prices up. In Germany, police use batons, pepper spray and water cannons to attack about 150 climate justice advocates who staged a nonviolent sit-in protest Saturday on a rail supply line leading to the harbor in Hamburg. The protesters are seeking to halt construction of new liquefied natural gas terminals along Germany's coast. This comes as German households face spiraling fuel costs that could see them spend hundreds of euros more per year to power their homes. This is protesting protest spokesperson Charlie Dietz.
In Germany, too, the energy crisis is hitting those hardest who contributed the least, crisis in which many bear the cost, while the few corporations pocket billions in profits. It is explicitly not an energy crisis. It is a capitalist distribution crisis.
Lawyers for Julian Assange have filed a lawsuit against the CIA and its former director, Mike Pompeo, charging they spied on U.S. lawyers and journalists who met Assange while he was living in the Ecuadorian embassy in London while in political asylum. The lawsuit is being filed as Britain prepares to extradite the WikiLeaks founder to the United States, where he faces up to 175 years in prison for violating the Espionage Act by publishing classified documents exposing U.S. war crimes in Iraq and Afghanistan. Later in the broadcast, we'll speak with the lead attorney behind the lawsuit. Here in New York, another person has died at the Rikers Island Jail Complex, the 12th so far this year. The New York Times reports Ricardo Cruciani was found Monday morning sitting in a shower area with a sheet around his neck. The 68-year-old died about an hour later. His attorney had reportedly alerted Rikers officials to put him on suicide watch. Cruciani was a former neurologist who was convicted 2 weeks ago of sexually assaulting and raping at least six of his patients. And in California, thousands of unionized mental health care providers in multiple cities have gone on strike, demanding the country's largest nonprofit health care organization provide better care to people who desperately need services. Kaiser Permanente serves some 9 million people in California. According to the Union of Healthcare Workers, Kaiser has just one mental health provider for every 2,600 patients, forcing people to wait months for an appointment. Union members are also accusing Kaiser of violating treatment clinical guidelines and California state laws. The strike comes after a year of negotiations between the National Union of Healthcare Workers and Kaiser, which has rejected union proposals to expand the workforce and improve access to care. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Justice Department has asked a federal judge not to unseal a sworn affidavit used by the FBI to recover 11 sets of secret government documents from Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago estate in Florida last week. The affidavit is the basis of an application that convinced a judge to sign off on the FBI's search warrant. In a federal court filing, prosecutors said the affidavit's release would compromise the continuing investigation and could chill the future cooperation of witnesses. The warrant, which was unsealed Friday, revealed Trump is being investigated for three federal crimes, violating the Espionage Act, obstruction of justice, and criminal handling of government records. Fallout from the FBI raid is continuing to grow as Republican lawmakers denounce the FBI, with Florida Senator Rick Scott comparing the agency to the Gestapo in Nazi Germany. Fox News host Jesse Waters has called for the firing of FBI Director Christopher Wray, who was appointed by Donald Trump.
Well, Chris Wray has to be fired by the next Republican president. Got to be fired on day one. Don't even wait. Just fire him right off the jump.
A growing number of Republicans are calling for the FBI to be defunded. Far-right Republican Congressmember Marjorie Taylor Greene tweeted on Monday, "Impeach Merrick Garland and defund the corrupt FBI. End political persecution and hold those accountable that abuse their positions of power to persecute their political enemies while ruining our country. This shouldn't happen in America. Republicans must force it to stop," Marjorie Taylor Greene tweeted. Others calling for the FBI to be defunded include Anthony Sabatini, a Republican congressional candidate in Florida.
I think every single candidate and elected official in the GOP right now needs to go on record pledging to defund these lawless agencies.
The Republican attacks on the FBI mark a radical shift for the party, which has long embraced the FBI. Last year, Democratic Congressmember Bobby Rush of Illinois introduced legislation to force the FBI to disclose more details of its secret COINTELPRO program in the 1960s to surveil and disrupt groups including the Black Panther Party and the American Indian Movement, as well as Martin Luther King Jr. and other individuals. The legislation had 24 co-sponsors, none of them Republican. To talk more about the FBI, we're joined by Alex Vitale, professor of sociology and coordinator of the Policing and Social Justice Project at Brooklyn College here in New York. He's the author of The End of Policing. His new piece for Truthout is headlined, "There Are Good Reasons to Defund the FBI. They Have Nothing to Do with Trump." Well, Professor Vitale, let's start there. It might shock many to hear, and we just chose a few clips, but they are growing around the country, defund the FBI from Republicans all over the United States.
Welcome back to CKUT. It's time for a little weather. Wednesday will be mainly cloudy with a chance of the showers and then thunderstorms later in the afternoon. There will be a high of 24 degrees Celsius. Thursday will be mainly cloudy with scattered showers throughout the day. The high will be 20 degrees Celsius. Friday promises variable clouds in the morning, becoming mainly sunny in the afternoon. The high will be 28 degrees Celsius. Saturday will be sunny throughout the day, with a high of 30 degrees Celsius. Sunday will be sunny with a chance of a sun shower in the afternoon. The high will be 30 degrees Celsius. Monday will be cloudy with a chance of showers in the morning and thunderstorms in the afternoon. The high will be 27 degrees Celsius. Finally, Tuesday will be cloudy with a risk of showers throughout the day. The high will be 26 degrees Celsius.
Welcome to Viewpoints. Parley Manufacturing Company, a Brooklyn-based business, is hoping to conquer Canada and beyond with a new product line and a fresh approach to their business. The business got advice from Nova Scotia Business, Inc. and Digital Nova Scotia. The company refreshed its website and will soon be selling new products directly to customers online. The Parley Manufacturing Company launched their versatile integrated packs that can be tailored to any situation. The goal is soon to have Parley products in the hands of first responders across Canada. More with Ed Halverson in Liverpool, Nova Scotia.
Parley Manufacturing launched their versatile integrated packs as a customizable off-the-shelf solution that can be tailored for any situation. Glenn Parley, president of Parley Manufacturing, says the product was born from the close relationships with first responder agencies across Nova Scotia.
Actually seeing how the product is used and talking to the people on the front lines, not a purchasing agent, but a person on the front lines that's using it, and asking the question, what would make your job easier? What would work better for your particular application? That's the information that we need to make a product that's always up to date and ready to go.
Members from EHS LifeFlight and the Department of Natural Resources and Renewables were on hand at the product launch to demonstrate how the modular system has been adapted to their particular uses. Even before the pandemic hit in 2020, Parley Manufacturing was looking for ways to better connect with their customers. With the help of Nova Scotia Business Inc. and Digital Nova Scotia, the company has rebranded and refreshed their websites and will be selling the new products direct to customers online. Parley says by cutting out the middleman, they can not only reduce costs and stay competitive against offshore producers, but give the customer what they want.
Maybe the setup that they see online, one of our sample ones, that maybe a local organization is using, doesn't sort of fit with their needs. We can help them decide, okay, if we change some of these with these accessories, this might work for you. And then we can, again, customize a pack without making a custom pack.
Parley and his wife Kathy started selling adventure products in 1985 and rebranded the business to Parley Manufacturing in 2003. With a full-time workforce of 9 people, they still produce everything in their shop in Brooklyn just outside Liverpool. Parley says when dealing with a larger order, the family business can bring in up to 15 people. Despite problems in other sectors, he doesn't see his company having an issue finding labor.
Our average employee is not sort of the average employee. Most of our seamstresses are folks that, you know, maybe are beyond, you know, their kids are gone back to school, or they may be folks that have their kids in school, so we're very flexible.
Parley says their products are already in use across Nova Scotia, and with the new product line, new business model, and new online presence, the goal is to have Parley products in the hands of first responders across Canada in short order. I'm Ed Halverson.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
So we stay on the East Coast, where research based on bird point count data gathered in the Maritimes Breeding Bird Atlas and published by Bird Studies Canada shows that forestry practices in the Maritimes have degraded the habitat of forest birds, causing their populations to rapidly decline. The research relies on large numbers of volunteer bird watchers that contribute their time and skills to gathering the data. To talk about this decline, our journalist David Gordon Kosh spoke with wildlife biologist Craig Campbell from the Canadian Wildlife Services, a bird expert who participated in gathering that data.
There are some species of birds where we know that almost the majority of them are declining, and those are things like aerial insectivores like swallows and shorebirds like you'd see at Johnson's Mills. For forest birds, it's a little bit of a more muddled picture because you have some species which do seem to be increasing and others which are declining. It does seem that most of the species that are declining tend to rely on old forest habitats, which corresponds with what this study found.
So what are some of the examples of bird species that we've seen on the decline in terms of forest birds that rely on these old forests that you were speaking about a moment ago?
Some of the ones we get are often the warbler species. Some of them like younger forests, but some of them like the Blackburnian warbler, which is pointed out in the paper, that do tend to prefer mixed forests that are kind of older and more complex in structure. They have been declining rapidly over the last 20 or 30 years, according to the Breeding Bird Survey data. So seeing something like this in another publication, which takes a different data source, also seems to confirm that and reinforce it.
What about bird species that you've seen that have actually increased? What are some examples, or what kind of habitats do they rely on?
One species that we've been seeing increasing a lot is the palm warbler, which originally the kind of their traditional habitat is sort of swamps and bogs, but they do seem to now like areas that are regenerating forest, so that kind of mimics the young stunted growth that you get in a bog. So those species have been increasing, according to the Breeding Bird Atlases and other data sources. So it's not that surprising to me that we'd be seeing increases, according to the methodology in the paper as well.
Just wondering if you could talk about your background a little bit in terms of research and also your experience in the Tanchmar area, which of course is known for its bird populations.
The last 5 years I've been working in Newfoundland as a boreal bird ecologist mostly, so I was part of a group that designed a monitoring program to monitor bird health across the boreal forests of Canada, and I'm mostly responsible for the Newfoundland and Labrador part of that. Previously, I lived in Sackville for about a dozen years, and I worked for an organization called Birds Canada, which at that time was working in the office with the Canadian Wildlife Service and is now in downtown Sackville. And at that point, I was working on many different things. I was running a coordinated project for owl surveys, so running these 18-kilometer routes all across New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, and PEI, and monitoring owl health, health of owl populations. I also participated a lot in the Maritimes Breeding Bird Atlas, which ran from 2006 to about 2010, and other projects as well, essentially all related to birds.
And so the data sources that are used in the study include things that you worked on directly in terms of...
Yeah, directly, yeah. Uh-huh. Both the data from the Breeding Bird Atlas, some of those data would have been ones I would have contributed to it, and also for the Breeding Bird Survey data that was used to compare with the paper's results. Some of those data would have also been ones that I'd gathered as well. So there was a paper that came out, I believe it was in 2019, where that showed that there were 3 billion fewer breeding birds in North America than there had been 50 years previously. And many of those birds were from forested habitats, and it kind of outlined deforestation as being a major cause, habitat degradation, and there were other factors as well. It's always been very difficult to measure habitat degradation, which is what's interesting about this paper. Was there a way of attempting to do that? But yes, it's been well established for, you know, we've kind of known anecdotally for years just by looking at the breeding bird survey trends that many species were in decline. And then since 2019 now, we have actually an estimate of how many fewer birds there are now than there were 50 years ago, and that's approximately 3 billion, which is a massive amount. It did generate a lot of news when that paper came out.
How serious do you think that this kind of loss of biodiversity is?
Well, it's clearly one of the major issues of our time, along with climate change, and they're not, you know, those two things are related to some degree. There is a lot of kind of doom and gloom type of news, but there's also some good news as well. So in 2019, there was the State of Canada's Birds was published, and it showed trends for all different bird species groups over the last 50 years. And some species were really declining, like the swallows and grassland birds like bobolink and shorebirds. But other species, and forest birds fell about in the middle of that, but other species like waterfowl and birds of prey, their populations had more than doubled over that same period of time. And that was entirely due to, you know, changes in the way we managed things. Populations were very, very low in the early 20th century because the waterfowl had been essentially hunted, in many cases, almost to extinction. Also, wetland conversion was a problem, and pesticide use was a problem for raptors. You know, DDT was causing, basically, removing the calcium and causing the birds of prey to crush their eggs when they sat on them to nest. But through, you know, banning the use of pesticides and then at more active management, hunting management, and recreation and restoration of wetlands, those populations actually doubled over the course of time. So we can do stuff to help this. It doesn't need to continue necessarily on this trajectory. Some of the issues we're facing now are larger scale than, you know, the overhunting or the use of pesticides, which was an easy one because we knew there was basically one cause for, you know, the declines to birds of prey, or one major cause. In our cases now, it's sometimes a little bit more complicated, but it is proof that something can be done about it, and, you know, not necessarily have to wait hundreds of years to see the result. It can happen fast.
That was David Gordon Kosh. We now go to Ontario, where the Prince Edward County Memorial Hospital Foundation has raised $20.7 million in donation for its new hospital, surpassing by 125% its original community goal. The Ontario government recently approved designs for the projected hospital, along with its prior commitment to cover 90% of the construction costs. Local dignitaries, including Prince Edward County Mayor Steve Ferguson, Mohawks of the Bay of Quinte Chief Ronald Maracle, and Member of Provincial Parliament Todd Smith, attended the foundation's Back to Build event. The Rick and Debbie Daynard family donated $1.5 million to the $20 million effort. The foundation is now looking for an additional $6 million to cover additional construction and equipment costs. They hope this will be achieved by 2027, the year the new hospital is expected to be in operation. More with Alexander Wright in Picton, Ontario.
Prince Edward County Memorial Hospital Foundation announced that it had raised $20.7 million in donations for its new hospital, 125% of its original community goal. This past April, the provincial government approved preliminary designs for the hospital along with its prior commitment to covering 90% of the construction costs. The community portion of the fundraising covered the remaining 10% of construction costs, as well as costs for the purchasing of new equipment. Local dignitaries, including Prince Edward County Mayor Steve Ferguson, Mohawks of the Bay of Quinte Chief R. Donald Maracle, and MPP Todd Smith, attended the foundation's Back to Build event, where they made the exceptional fundraising announcement. As well, Rick and Debbie Daynard were present to officially contribute their major donation of $1.25 million to the community effort. Now the foundation's goal is to raise $6 million more to cover additional construction and equipment costs. The hope is that this will be achieved by 2027, the year the new hospital is expected to be in operation. The next generation hospital is now projected to be 95,000 square feet in size, sporting smart technology, a CT scanner, and will have a net zero carbon footprint, a potential first in North America.
Hey, I'm Anastasia Avakumova in beautiful British Columbia, and you are tuned to Viewpoints.
Hello, lovely people, and welcome to In the Shower with Taz and Marcus, a bite-sized informative podcast aimed to be listened to in the shower, but you can listen to it absolutely anywhere.
And we mean anywhere. You can listen to it while you're insulating your house.
You can listen to it in Sweden.
You can listen to it in Antwerp.
Anywhere, really. People do listen in Antwerp. Shout out to Linda, who sent us a question from Antwerp a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
So, Taz, what's the point of this podcast?
The whole point of this podcast is that we aim to answer the mysteries of the world so you don't have to. Listeners send in the questions they've always wondered the answer to, but never quite went as far as looking up. Thus far, we've answered questions like...
What is the story with pineapples?
How much wood would a woodchuck chuck if a woodchuck could chuck wood?
Do plants have feelings?
And loads, loads more. I suppose you could say...
We expand your mind while you wash your sexy behind.
And this week is no different. I'm so excited for this one.
This week's a really interesting question, genuinely. All the way from Chicago.
I know, it's so great that we're getting so many international questions. This one comes from Indy in Chicago. And the question is...
Why do our fingers get wrinkly when submerged in water?
So this question is from Indy, and she is listening all the way in Chicago in the United States of America.
Yeehaw, America!
Good, Marcus. I lived in Chicago for about a year, and it was absolutely class. So Indy, I'm jealous that you're there, and I'm here in rainy Ireland.
To be fair, at least it's not snowing anymore.
I never want to see snow again after the past week. We, of course, are talking about the Beast from the East.
But no more about that. It's in our past. We don't... Oh, God. Indy, thank you very much for sending in a brilliant question. I'm actually surprised no one has asked this question before, because it, as soon as you asked it, it was like we were both sucked in.
Yeah.
Properly. Why do our fingers go wrinkly when submerged in water?
That is exactly it, and it's such a good question. But before we start, I think it's worth mentioning, it's not only your fingers, but also your palms and toes and the soles of your feet.
Yeah, that's the weird thing. I feel like if it happened to our whole bodies, it'd be far easier to explain. As in, it's just a basic reaction of skin to water.
Yeah.
But it just happens to be specific parts of the body.
Absolutely, and that fact alone has a lot to do with the research that has kind of been carried out attempting to answer this question.
You've researched this, Taz, so go on.
Okay, so until the early 20th century, most scientists attributed the pruny finger phenomenon to osmosis. Did you listen in science class, Marcus? Do you know what osmosis is?
It's like the one thing that I actually remember from science in the Leaving Series. Like, osmosis is the movement of a liquid through a membrane from a place of low concentration to a place of high concentration. Is that it? Or do I have it backwards?
Yeah, something along those lines. So the exact definition is a process by which molecules of a solvent tend to pass through a semi-permeable membrane from a less concentrated solution into a more concentrated one. Or, in this case, the movement of water into dry outer layers of the skin.
So in this case, the skin is the membrane and the water passes from the area of high concentration, which, like a bath or the sea, can't really get much higher concentration than that. It's a body of water. Through the membrane, which is the skin, to an area of low concentration, which is the dry outer layers of your skin.
Exactly. So this movement of water was thought to puff up the skin covering the tips of our hands and feet. And such action kind of expands the skin's surface and was assumed to lead to the visible wrinkles of the skin in the fingers and toes. So if you think about it, water is going into your fingers through osmosis and kind of causing those little puffy lumps.
That makes sense in a way, but that doesn't explain why it only happens to your toes and fingers. I mean, it should kind of happen to your whole body then.
Well, that's exactly the reason research was sort of opened up again about 15 years ago. So for the last 100 years or so, it was thought to be osmosis. And then 15 years ago, new research was conducted into the wrinkly finger phenomenon. So it was conducted by this guy called Mark Changizi, who's a theoretical neurobiologist and director of human cognition at two AI labs in the best place name in the world, Boise, Idaho.
Boise. So what did Mark Changizi look into?
Changizi started looking at primates because we, of course, evolved from primates. He hoped that looking at the hands of our ancestors would offer some advice, but what he actually found was better than what he could have imagined.
Ooh, oh my God, the anticipation. What did he find?
Okay, so whilst investigating the shape, function and structure of primates' hands, he came across a bunch of studies, starting in the 1930s and going through to about 2000. Mm-hmm. In them, surgeons learned that if certain nerves to the fingers were cut, the wrinkling response would disappear. Wrinkled fingers, then, are signs of an intact nervous system.
Wow, okay. So no nerves, no wrinkly response. Meaning that it couldn't just be osmosis then, because obviously osmosis is an external stimulus, so it wouldn't really be affected by your nervous system.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And this obviously offered loads more information on the topic. And what's even better, the wrinkling response has since been suggested as a means of determining whether the sympathetic nervous system is functioning in patients that are otherwise unresponsive.
So that's amazing.
Yeah.
I never knew that. That's really fascinating. So we know it's to do with the nerves and then not the skin. So we don't know why it happens, surely still, do we?
Whether and how the wet wrinkling response may have evolved, and if it even represents an adaptation in the first place, remains a continuous debate.
Adaptation as in it serves a purpose to, like, a changing external environment. Your fingers and toes wrinkle because it aids you with something else.
Exactly. And back to our fave scientist, Mark Changizi, he thinks it's most certainly got to be an adaptation. So if we think of tire threads, for example, tires on cars, in dry conditions, smooth tires can maintain their grip on asphalt, which explains why race cars typically have smooth, featureless, flat tires, okay? Mm. But when driving in rain, threads are far safer, so having kind of threads on the wheels. And then again, if we think of hiking boots, having grooves and kind of an uneven surface on the sole of your boot allows you to grip better.
So is that Changizi's theory that our fingers go wrinkly in water to help with grip?
It's extremely difficult to prove that any biological feature is an adaptation, let alone why it may have evolved over thousands of years. But Changizi and his extended team began looking for hints or details in the fingertips and the toes and the soles of their feet that might indicate that a feature may have indeed evolved as an adaptation.
And what did they find? Did they come to any kind of conclusion?
So in 2011, which isn't that long ago, Changizi and his colleagues found evidence that wrinkled fingers can act as rain threads, channeling water away from the fingers and toes during wet conditions, allowing primates, humans and macaques to be specific, to maintain a tighter grip.
Right, I think I get you. Just, listen, explain that again one more time, because I am dense as underproved bread.
So the wrinkles that result from exposure to water can be thought of as tiny manual river drainage systems. So in a typical watershed, multiple streams combine into larger channels, which eventually dump water into, you know, a river somewhere, a central river.
So the pattern on our fingertips acts as tiny streams, and when our fingers get wrinkly, they form new grooves, and all the moisture from the tiny streams join in the grooves and get rid of water.
That's exactly it. So it was a method of draining water from your fingertips so that you can maintain a better grip. So how they figured out what the drainage system was comparing it to riverbeds. And to see if wrinkled primates' fingers had similar features to river basins, Changizi and his team analysed pictures of about 28 human fingers. And they found that wrinkled fingers had the exact inverse formation as river drainages.
What?
Yeah, yeah. With kind of the same raised, interconnected bit of bumpy skin, you know, punctuated by diverging, disconnected, sunken channels.
That's mental. I mean, shout out to Mark Changizi for looking at wrinkled fingers and going, riverbeds.
I know.
So imagine a completely flat finger with no pattern whatsoever, not even like finger or not even a fingerprint. Mm-hmm. Your fingers might slide when trying to grip something, but because it's a bit wrinkled, you have a better grip because it's channeling water away, making your fingers less slippy, right?
Mm-hmm.
In order to wrinkle the skin, water needs to be removed from the surface, and there's proof that fingertips resemble water basins, which remove water from riverbeds.
Yeah, that's
meaning your fingers use the same systems to channel water away as a river. Like there's some awesome symbiosis here going on between Mother Nature.
Yeah.
in both the rivers and fingertips.
And then there's this. So wrinkles don't appear until around 5 minutes of constant exposure to water, meaning that incidental contact isn't enough to result in wrinkling or pruning. The response only becomes useful in rainy or dewy conditions.
Pruning.
Pruning.
That's a great word. So if it wasn't a case of adaptation, it would occur as soon as water touched the surface of your skin then?
That's how it would seem. And even better still, it occurs more quickly in response to fresh water than seawater, which could reflect the circumstances in which it may have originally evolved in primates.
Because primates aren't usually close to the sea?
That's what Changizi and his team came back with.
Seems like a very long-winded explanation, though. I mean, the riverbed and all that just to prove wrinkled fingers aid grip in wet conditions. Surely you could just set up a basic enough experiment and just test the theory with normal people.
You have led me perfectly onto my next point.
Oh no, poor Changizi.
Okay, so in 2013, thumbs down, a group of British neuroscientists conducted a similar experiment, and guess what they found?
I hope it's something obscure, like a whole new theory, like your fingers are actually trying to grow smaller fingers out of your already established fingers.
No,
or something.
No. They uncovered evidence that wrinkled fingers aided people in manipulating wet objects.
Really?
Yep.
Okay, cool.
So in that experiment, 20 people had to transfer 45 objects of different sizes, all marbles and fishing weights, from one container into another. In some cases, the objects were dry, while the participants' fingers were either smooth or wrinkled. In other cases, the objects were submerged. They found that wrinkled fingers allowed the participants to more quickly transfer the objects when submerged, though they made no difference to dry objects.
That's madness. So we have a solid answer. Your fingers wrinkle to aid grip in wet conditions.
Not exactly.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
I know.
So do we have a conclusive answer?
No. I hate when we can't come to a conclusive answer, but this one is so new. This whole study is so new. And in 2014, a study conducted by German researchers found the exact opposite to that previous British study. So in that study, the researcher had 40 people transferring 52 marbles and dices of different sizes and weights from one container into another. And they found, however, that there was no significant difference in participants' ability to manipulate the objects, no matter if their fingers were wet or wrinkled or the objects were dry or submerged.
This is mental.
What's more, a group of Taiwanese researchers conducted a series of experiments with a 24-year-old male volunteer. And this experiment was a bit more scientific, and they looked at the friction between his fingers and the items he was touching. They assessed the friction applied to a smooth surface by his smooth or wrinkled fingertips. For example, how much force his hand applied when sliding kind of across the bar. You would think, with the whole experiment that we just did, if wrinkled hands gripped better, there would be more friction.
But wrinkled hands actually had no effect on the measured friction.
Yeah, they actually found that wrinkled hands resulted in decreased performance for the test.
So we don't have a finite answer to this at all.
Not exactly. But there are a few kind of theories behind it. Marcus, give us a lowdown on what you can kind of recall from Changizi and where this all started.
So originally people thought that fingers became wrinkled through osmosis and was just the surface area of your finger expanding when water went from an area of high concentration into the dry layers of skin in your fingers. But Mark Changizi, who's a scientist in Boise, Idaho, said, no, it isn't. I think this is an adaptation. So he looked at riverbeds and like typical naturally occurring water drainage systems and found that there are vast similarities between the shapes of water drainage systems in naturally occurring places and the ones that happen on your fingers when they wrinkle. So he thought that it was an adaptation. But then another team found that, yes, your grip improved when you had wrinkly fingers, but then another team kind of disproved it.
That's pretty kind of up there, but Changizi still maintains his answer, and he thinks that the wet wrinkling response is only useful when supporting one's own body weight, not for small tasks, saying if you're really going to do a behavioral test where it matters, it should be gripping onto trees or heavier things, not like marbles.
Is this kind of based in primates? Like obviously like primates aren't really concerned about lifting marbles and small weights and bananas and primate things with wrinkly fingers. They're more concerned about actually being able to swing from tree to tree and manipulate their bodies in essential kind of bodyweight supporting ways.
That's exactly it. And the tests are still ongoing. And what's more, Changizi is still on the mission and he has thought of the perfect experiment to prove his theory, recruiting parkour experts to show off their urban acrobatics with either wrinkled or non-wrinkled fingers in wet or dry conditions. And he adds that it has to be done in some sort of safe way.
I would love to be a fly on the wall when Changizi's trying to get insurance for that. So, I mean, like, if that's kind of non-conclusive, do we have some facts?
Of course we do. This is a lovely one. Are you ready?
Mm-hmm.
The vein on your ring finger is called vena amoris. It has a direct line with the human heart and is known as the vein of love.
Oh.
And that's why we wear our engagement finger on the left hand's ring finger.
That's really sweet.
Cute, isn't it?
Any more?
Yeah, this one's not so sweet.
What is it?
When I was born, I had an extra toe on my left foot.
It's been fairly grippy.
Well, there you go. A pretty sciencey one, but interesting nonetheless.
Yeah, absolutely. I think my brain got a bit wet and then it wrinkled and got a grip on the facts in that episode. So thank you, Mark Changizi, for providing some adaptation for our physical beings.
And thank you, Indy from Chicago, for sending that question in.
I feel like I've learned a little something today. Next time I have like a 3-hour long bath watching David Attenborough specials and I look at my wrinkled fingers, I'll think of David Attenborough, who loves a bit of adaptation. And yeah, and then I'll grip things. Well, that sounded a bit dirty.
Guys, thank you so much for listening to that episode. If it happens to be your first episode of In the Share with Taz and Marcus, or your second, or your third, we have a massive bank of episodes available online or on whatever podcast app you use.
This is our 31st episode.
Yeah, it's so exciting.
That's mad. So yeah, go back and listen to some episodes, learn some facts, expand your mind, hopefully wash your behind as well. Nobody got time for your smelly ass.
If you have a question that you would like debunked over the course of your shower, no matter how big or small, there's no such thing as a silly question. You can get in touch with us and we will do our best to debunk it. You can get us on social media.
If you want to get us on Facebook, just look up In the Shower with Taz and Marcus. Or if you're more of a Twitter kind of person, get in touch by twittering at In the Shower Pod.
If you're an old-fashioned guy or gal, you can email us at intheshowerpodcast@gmail.com. And if you just want to get in touch and say hi, we would love that also.
That would be sound. Give us a virtual hug.
A few thank yous to close off the episode.
A huge thank you to all of the folks in Headstuff. Paddy, Rebecca, Alan, you are heroes. Thank you for hosting us every single week.
Next up, thank you Flo Robinson for our lovely cover art. A link to her Instagram page is on our show notes, so you should check that out.
Next up, thank you to the genie of jingles, David Gertzman, for coming up with a theme song, which goes a little like this. 1, 2, 3, 4. Bum tika bum ba bum tika bum ba 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 bum tika bum ba bum. Thank you, Dave Gertzman, you absolute legend. So Taz, what is next week's question?
Next week's question came all the way from Brazil. We're answering so many international questions and it's absolutely brilliant.
All the way from Brazil?
All the way from Brazil, from a gal called Luisa Carada.
Luisa has asked us a very, very interesting question. She says, why are our anatomical features dictated by where we come from? As in, why do we have different skin colours and different eye shapes? This is going to be a really, really interesting question and I cannot wait to answer it.
That episode is going to be out next Monday in time for your morning shower. But in the meantime,
keep scrubbing. Scrubbing.
This podcast is part of the Headstuff Podcast Network.
Discovering new music? This is the station. Hi, my name is Ezra Brooks, and you're listening to The New Spins Library on C-Cut Radio.
Dreams.
But the fates were not done with our story, so our hearts collided for a second beat. But now, where do we go? What if I tell you I'm nothing, baby? Why can't we see? Why are we fighting what's supposed to be? Oh no, we can't let this go. I see it in your eyes up on the stage, holding me hostage in your gaze. Hey boy, you're my rock and roll. What if I tell you I'm nothing, baby? What if I show you I don't mean maybe? Call it.
cette étincelle entre nous.
Well, that wraps up the New Spins Library for today. Remember, you can listen back at cqut.ca programming and archives, or get the interviews and playlists on YouTube. Just type the New Spins Library into the YouTube search bar, subscribe, and get access to weekly interviews and playlists of videos. It's been fun. Have a great week. Terminal 5 and the Sleepy King are up next.
Sleepy King Radio, de retour en studio à CKUT.